September 15, 1963 started off just like any other Sunday for Barbara Cross, with morning Sunday school class down in the basement of 16th Street Baptist Church. Cross remembers that day's Sunday school lesson.
And our Sunday school lesson that day was a love that forgives. I'll never forget that as long as I live. In my class particular, we discuss the scripture from Matthew, the 5th chapter, about talking about agape love, the godly type of love, and agape is the Greek word for godly love.
It was the first time Pastor John Cross, Barbara's father, initiated Youth Sunday under his ministry. After class, the children were getting ready for their other responsibilities that Sunday.
I remember a good friend of mine came by the classroom, and we were going to go to the bathroom together. And my teacher stopped me. My teacher's name was Mrs. DeMann. And she gave me an assignment that literally spared my life and kept me out of harm's way.
Cross was asked to write the names of those who would be moving up to the next age level in Sunday school. It was just a few minutes later that Sunday would soon be marred by an explosion that would change Birmingham forever.
And I remembered I was in the process of writing the names down. The most horrific noise that I had ever heard in my life. I remember the building shaking. I remembered hearing children screaming.
4 young girls died, many more injured, and a community ripped apart by an act of violence on what was supposed to be a peaceful Sunday. Don Brown was a general assignment reporter for the Birmingham News during the early 60s. He was at a church 3 blocks away when the bomb went off.
It was after the church service that I told my wife, take the car on home. I'm going to see what's happened down the street here. And as soon as I saw what's happened, I got a ride to work with a photographer and stayed at work until after midnight that Sunday night.
Local and national media outlets have been criticized for being slow to cover the civil rights movement in Birmingham. But by the summer of 1963, every major news outlet had someone on the ground. After the explosion that rocked the country, news spread fast. And at the Cross residence, the phone was constantly busy right after the explosion, from reporters to family members, like Barbara Cross's uncle in Virginia.
And I remember my mama telling me that he had to interrupt the line because he remembered there was a broadcast, an NBC report, of one of the major networks that said the 16th Street Baptist Church was bombed in Birmingham, Alabama. And my uncle said, that's my brother-in-law's church. And he told the operator, you got to get me through to that line. I want to be sure if my family is okay.
It wasn't long until word spread that Sunday and everyone around the nation knew what had transpired in Birmingham.
I was preparing, getting ready for church because I went to Sunday school. And my brother called me, said, come quick, something is happening in Birmingham.
Charles Avery was living just outside of Chicago at the time, but he never forgot his Birmingham roots.
When we heard it on the news, we were almost compelled to get in the car and come to Birmingham then. At that moment, we were so excited and wanted to get back home.
Avery sensed what many were feeling. Former Birmingham news reporter Don Brown says something big was about to happen.
If you could equate the feeling around the city those next few days to somebody having a nervous breakdown, Birmingham was having a serious nervous breakdown.
2 young men were killed later that day, and the National Guard was brought in to keep the peace in the days following the bombing. As national and international media ramped up their coverage, they echoed what Don Brown would hear while covering the Young Men's Business Club in Birmingham.
One of the lawyers, whom I respected, just got up and told his colleagues, Birmingham is dead. This was after the church bombing. And that was the feeling that the national media and Birmingham itself had left itself with. When we saw what we had done at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and I say we because everybody in Birmingham was blamed for that.
50 years later now, and Chuck Morgan's words still ring in the city. Birmingham isn't dead, but it still carries the scars of September 15th with it. And at 16th Street Baptist Church, where it comes up in this first Sunday service.
Don't wait to September 15th. To give God some praise. Amen. Every day is a day of thanksgiving. You might not be here September 15th.
The church has taken on civil rights history as a ministry, offering tours of the church and basement where the bomb went off. Pastor Arthur Price Jr.
We've increased our tour ministry when we've gotten here. We have great volunteers who don't mind telling the story. We produced a documentary chronicling the events of 1963 and the bombing of the church and the trials, bringing the perpetrators to justice. So every year we know that people make a pilgrimage to come to Birmingham to see what happened here 50 years ago.
And it's not uncommon to find visitors from all over taking in a church service on any given Sunday.
Good morning. We have Berea College from Berea, Kentucky, visiting with us on a civil rights tour led by Dr. Alistine Tunley. If you could, would you please stand at this time?
Pastor Price says he has already received calls from over 350 people to attend service on the 50th anniversary this year, including from the White House. On that day, they will recreate the service from September 15th, including the Sunday school lesson that day, A Love That Forgives.
Ye have heard that it had been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thy enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you.
An ironic lesson from 50 years ago, and what could be a fitting reminder 50 years later. I'm Ryan Vasquez, APR News in Birmingham.
50 years ago, a bomb exploded at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. Four young girls were killed in the blast. It would take 14 years before the first Klansman was tried and convicted in the bombing. Robert Chambliss was found guilty of his part in the attack. He wound up here at the St. Clair County Correctional Facility, about 40 miles northeast of Birmingham. It's here where Chambliss wrote letters to his family during his time in prison. The handwritten letters and the pictures they paint from that time can now be found with just a short ride down a creaky elevator to the bowels of the Archives Department at the Birmingham Public Library.
April 20, 1979. Yes, Mommy, you told me you called the governor. Mommy, I ask you again, did you talk to the governor? Did you call my lawyer? What did he say?
Mommy is Chambliss's wife in a letter read by library archivist Jim Baggett.
Wrote the governor a nice 2.5-page letter. The reason, he sent the lieutenant governor's staff over here to talk to me. Tell our little Bobby to write one. Put in your letter so it won't cost her postage. Answer soon, your loving husband. R.E. Chambliss.
Baggett has been studying those decade-old letters in detail.
Chambliss is almost entirely focused on himself in his letters. There's a lot of self-pity, and, you know, he presents himself as a victim. And he never acknowledges involvement in the bombings. But, no, there's no remorse. There's no acceptance of responsibility at all.
In 1963, Chambliss was better known by his nickname, Dynamite Bob. Prosecutors at the time called him a skilled bomb maker, responsible for several racially motivated attacks in Birmingham, though the number isn't clear. Baggett says one element was race, not that of his victims, but rather his own.
His self-worth comes from the fact that there's this whole other group of people he can look down upon and dominate. So I think this accounts for a lot of the reason that people like Chambliss reacted so violently to civil rights activity, because it wasn't just an attack on the social system that they lived in that was segregated. It was an attack on their whole self-image and their own self-worth and how they saw themselves.
Other observers of the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing have a more straightforward assessment of Chambliss.
The thing that I recall most about him is just a deep sense of meanness. Someone who had such a deep hatred.
Dr. Art Dunning is a professor at the University of Alabama. He was one of just a few African Americans to attend the Tuscaloosa campus in 1966, 3 years after the stand in the schoolhouse door. He agrees white supremacists were threatened by this change in social order, and that's what spurred the violence.
I do think the Chambliss's of the world saw this social order crumbling, where just by hereditary advantage, that certain things, I don't have to do anything, just be born in a certain group. I have this distinct advantage. And I think that was disturbing to them.
Back at the Archives Department at the Birmingham Public Library, Jim Baggett uses a cart to retrieve Chambliss's letters from a sea of filing boxes. He pulls out another one. It's also addressed to his wife, dated April 25th, 1979.
I don't trust my lawyer. They're giving big meetings all around, taking up big collections. What are they doing with the money? He said it's being put in the bank, First National Bank in North Birmingham, in your name. Mommy, I could tell you something that would make your hair stand on your head, but I won't. I can't sleep but about 30 minutes at the time. I hardly ever lay down till 11 or 12 o'clock. Mommy, I got plenty to tell you when and if I ever get out. It would make you all want to kill somebody.
Chambliss wrote dozens of letters over the next 6 years. He never did successfully get out of prison as he had tried to for as long as he was incarcerated. Chambliss died behind bars in October 1985. There's still a connection between the prison and the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. One of Chambliss's accomplices, Thomas Blanton, is still serving a life sentence there. Maggie Martin, APR News in Birmingham.
There's always a Budweiser truck that passes on this tour. It's like a sign or something. I don't know. Too bad it's not in the afternoon. Like that never stopped me. Okay.
Professor Jason Black is on a stroll through history.
And as you can imagine, the campus was in somewhat of an uproar. Lined along the streets here, all the way down to about where Arby's is and some of the...
Instead of using a chalkboard, he's taking his class to sites on the campus of the University of Alabama that are related to the civil rights movement. These students walk these streets every day. Black paints pictures of what was going on in the late 1950s and early 60s.
There's a cross that's not yet burned, but it's placed about where those recycling bins are that really welcome her when the car stops here at the intersection.
Next Tuesday marks 50 years since the stand in the schoolhouse door. That's when Governor George Wallace tried to keep two African-American students from enrolling at the Tuscaloosa campus in 1963. The names of Vivian Malone and James Hood are etched in civil rights history, but they weren't the first.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So things were said to her, things were thrown at her. But think about your day-to-day. What do you do on a daily basis? You walk to classes, right?
He's referring to Authorine Lucy. She enrolled in Tuscaloosa in 1956, 7 years before Malone and Hood. Black says the reception wasn't welcoming.
One of the images there on the next page over, you'll see, is a group of pro-segregationist folks. They're burning in effigy a copy of the Brown v. Board decision.
Lucy lasted 3 days before leaving the campus. In 1963, Hood and Malone wanted to follow in Lucy's footsteps. Dr. Culpepper Clark doesn't need a walking tour about that. He's author of the book, The Schoolhouse Door.
Well, it's an iconic moment. It pitted the Kennedy administration against the South's most defiant champion of segregation, George Wallace.
The University of Alabama campus at Tuscaloosa is under a tight security guard of state police as Governor George Wallace appeals for calm and prepares to confront a deputy U.S. attorney.
I stand here today as governor of this sovereign state and refuse to willingly submit to illegal usurpation of power by the central government.
Culpepper Clark.
The Kennedy administration were fearful that if they had to move him forcibly from the door, that is, lay hands on him, that they would have an arrest scenario that would lead to a constitutional crisis over the 10th Amendment.
The 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution sets out which powers go to the federal government and which ones are retained by the states.
And they certainly wanted to avoid that, and in the end, Wallace did step aside.
5 minutes after the governor leaves, James Hood is the first of his race to become a University of Alabama student. He is followed into the registrar's office by Vivian Malone.
Well, I would just like to say that I'm glad that the registration is over and everything is over now. I think we can get down to studying. This is our main purpose here, and I'm glad that it has all been over now, and all we have to do now is get down, go get our books, and start studying.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
President John F. Kennedy.
This afternoon, following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro.
Behind the measured words from both President Kennedy and Governor Wallace, there was concern. Dr. Clark says it wasn't over what was going on between the White House and the Alabama governor's mansion, but how the public might react.
The university and Governor Wallace were determined not to have another Ole Miss crisis, as occurred on September 30th, 1962, where there was an actual shootout with a couple of deaths.
There was reason for both sides to be worried. One day after the stand in the schoolhouse door, Mississippi's NAACP organizer Medgar Evers was gunned down in front of his home. Foster Auditorium, where the stand took place, has been renovated, and the University of Alabama says progress has been made since then.
My name is Judy Bonner. I have the privilege of serving as president of the University of Alabama.
50 years later, the University of Alabama welcomed members of Congress to a ceremony where the original doors where George Wallace stood in support of segregation have been preserved. Congressman and civil rights activist John Lewis of Georgia was part of the delegation.
And I just felt like reaching out, touching the doors. But it was so sacred and so special, I refused to touch.
Lewis made his comments beside a clock tower in front of Foster Auditorium, with clock faces on all four sides. Three of the faces look out on the University of Alabama campus. The fourth looks back on Foster Auditorium, where the stand in the schoolhouse door took place 50 years ago. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Tuscaloosa.
Outside the old Birmingham jail, the focus of attention for today's crowd is what's hidden beneath a large flag of the state of Alabama. It's a historic marker to remember an event from 50 years ago.
One day, the South will recognize its real heroes. They will be the James Merediths, courageously and with a majestic sense of purpose.
Student Cecil Washington Jr. reads from the letter from Birmingham jail. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. put pen to paper back in 1963 after he was arrested for protesting against segregation.
Today we stand united, black and white, old and young, various religions, all coming together to say that we're grateful that that...
Birmingham Mayor William Bell was there, as well as Governor Robert Bentley.
We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement. This is just a part of that, and we're going to continue throughout the year to celebrate the Civil Rights Movement.
But for many in the crowd, Bell and Bentley were just the warm-up acts. The keynote speaker, Bernice King, is the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr.
What happened with many of those who sacrificed their lives, not just my father, but Fred Shuttlesworth, and not just the adults, but the young people who put their very lives on the line to demonstrate the injustices and the horrible atrocities that were taking place here in Birmingham to sensitize this nation to the struggle that was taking place in the South.
Later we spoke with King, who says it's important for people to hear and understand the message her father presented in his letter from the Birmingham jail, and how this site can help with the job of making it all real.
The letter, I think, speaks to all generations. It speaks to all people, because even if the specific situation of Birmingham changed, as my mother said, struggle is a never-ending process. Freedom is never really won. You earn it and win it in every generation.
On this quiet Sunday, other landmarks connected to the civil rights movement sit not far from the site of the Birmingham jail. Kelly Ingram Park was the site of demonstrations, including the so-called Children's March. Across the street, things are a lot more lively. Today, the 16th Street Baptist Church is bustling with energy, but 50 years ago, the mood was different. This was the site of one of the most tragic events of the civil rights movement.
As a result of this church being the place, the so-called headquarters, we believe it was targeted for the bombing.
Arthur Price Jr. is the current pastor at the church. He says four young girls ages 11 to 14 were lost in that blast.
They planted 22 sticks of dynamite, put some dirt over it, had a timer, went off 10:22.
The church was opened in 1873. Pastor Price points out one of the most recognizable features, and that's the Wales window. Called so because it was paid for by donations from children from Wales. The window was considered very controversial when it was unveiled.
They say black man suffering in the South similar to Christ suffering on the cross, and it has one hand pushing out oppression, the other hand open for forgiveness.
The church brings in around 40,000 visitors a year who come to see the building and learn about the events associated with it. The Birmingham Civil Rights Institute is across the street. Ahmad Ward is the head of education and exhibitions at the Institute. He says their obvious mission is to educate and inform people of what happened, but he says there's more to it than that.
We got an unwritten goal to improve relations, you know, between religion, races, creeds, gender. So besides our physical exhibition component, we do a lot of programming.
Some of the exhibits are meant to be uplifting, while others are designed to be disturbing. One example is called the Confrontation Room.
There are good ones and bad ones, just like black people.
Visitors hear racial epithets and see a full Ku Klux Klan robe on display in the back of the room. The self-guided tour then goes through the progression of the civil rights movement, from Montgomery to Birmingham to Washington, D.C. Ward says one of the prized exhibits is the door from Martin Luther King Jr.'s jail cell when he was arrested in Birmingham.
This is that one thing we probably shouldn't let anybody touch, but we let everybody touch it. But to me, this is probably the most valuable thing we have because of its historical significance.
This site draws in nearly 150,000 visitors a year from across the country and all over the world. They come to Alabama to see where the foot soldiers and leaders of the civil rights movement marched and bled, were imprisoned and made their stand to ensure equal rights for future generations to come. I'm Stan Ingold, APR News in Birmingham.
Finally threw a bomb into the bus. The bus filled very rapidly with black smoke. All of us realized that the bus was on fire.
If you've ever been to a high school reunion, they can be a little nerve-wracking. But tonight's gathering at the Tuskegee Human and Civil Rights Multicultural Center has a different vibe. For the former students here, all in their 60s now, it's not so much a reunion as it is a reflection. They're looking back on what was supposed to be the first day of classes on September 2nd, 1963. Former student Willie Wyatt Jr. was one of the 13 black students integrating Tuskegee High School.
I thought, well, okay, there's going to be 300 to 400 other kids in the school. How am I going to make friends? How am I going to be accepted? Is there anything that's going to happen that is going to cause me to react and respond? So that was kind of the thought running through my head.
But Wyatt never made it to the first day of class. No one did. That's because Alabama Governor George Wallace intervened to stop the school from desegregating. Wyatt vividly remembers what happened that morning.
The school was surrounded by state troopers, and the 13 of us who boarded the bus got to the driveway of the school, and Captain Pryor of the Alabama State Patrol got on the bus and gave us all a copy of an executive order from the governor denying us admission to the school.
Jean Hornsby Korkulis also recalls that day. She would have started her senior year. She was supposed to be one of Wyatt's classmates. Tonight is the first time they've ever met. But Korkulis says her concerns were different from Wyatt's.
In retrospect, to think of the courage that it took for you 13 to do that, to make history. And, you know, and my little petty annoyances about not being able to go to school with the same people I'd gone to school with all my life, you know, and worried about the prom and football games and things like that, you know. And then this, in here with these courageous 13.
Former student Rebecca Wadsworth Sickles is also at tonight's event. She was supposed to start her junior year at Tuskegee High. She remembers the swarm of state troopers Wyatt talked about earlier. Sickles recalls that while she and her siblings felt intimidated, her mother did not.
At one point, she turned around and asked all of us, it was about 7 or 8, do you students want to go to school? And we all said, yes, ma'am. And so she walked up to the nearest trooper who was standing stone-faced and said, please give a message to Governor Wallace that these students want to attend school. And, of course, he said nothing.
Bear in mind, Sickles is white. She was one of the few Caucasian students to go back to Tuskegee High when it reopened about a week later. She describes the school atmosphere as eerie, but her time there would be cut short.
It was scary for me, and I'm sure it was scary for those few black students that were in there. And one day in the middle of the school day, my daddy came to take me out. He said he was afraid for me to stay there.
Sickles' family sent her to live with her aunt and uncle in Alexander City. She wasn't the only white student to be pulled out of Tuskegee High. In just a matter of days, all the white students were gone. Their families transferred them to two nearby Macon County schools, Shorter and Notasulga. The move forced Tuskegee High School to close in January 1964, and a federal court ordered some of the black students to go to Shorter and some to attend Notasulga. Many were caught off guard by the turn of events, but no one more so than Anthony Lee and his family.
We had the understanding and we had prepared for a very smooth transition.
Lee was one of the lead plaintiffs in Lee versus Macon County Board of Education. It was the 1963 court case that forced Tuskegee High School to desegregate in the first place. So what played out September 2nd was not what Lee or his family was expecting.
The event that happened that day caught us by surprise because we thought we had prepared for everything and everything was supposed to be a very smooth transition until the closing and things like that happened.
With the help of civil rights attorney Fred Gray, Lee versus Macon County was expanded as a blanket desegregation order. It would apply to more than 100 school districts in the state. But that decision would not be handed down for nearly 4 years, long after Anthony Lee and his classmates were supposed to graduate. Lee and fellow senior classmate Willie Wyatt Jr. were given their diplomas in 64, but never made it to a formal graduation ceremony. They had been transferred to Notasulga, and just a few days before graduation, the school was burned to the ground during this time of change. Maggie Martin, APR News in Tuskegee.